Today it's a real privilege for me to be in the home with Dr. Bill Wilson, my mentor and friend for over 25 years, who has taught me more than any one person in my career the issues of integrating faith and practice. Bill, I just want to thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us and to be part of the Christian Legacy in Psychiatry series.
It's my pleasure to be here.
It's seemed almost eerie for me to go back to Duke Hospital yesterday and meet with Dan Blazer, the same hallways where I worked as a resident 25 years ago, and to be in this house where we had so many meetings of that group of interested believers to discuss topics. Tell me a little bit about how this program that was at Duke on Christianity and Medicine, tell me a little bit about how that got started.
Well, it all began as a result of a move of the Holy Spirit in my own life. When I first became a Christian, I was 44 years old and already a full professor for a year at Duke. I had tenure, so they couldn't fire me because I was a Christian. And a lady came to me one day and was very angry. She was a patient of mine. She had ulcerative colitis and also had been sexually abused when she was a child by a brother-in-law. She was filled with anger and rage toward men. Anything would tick her off. And I said to her, Edna, you are a very angry woman, and the only way I know that you're ever going to get rid of your anger is to forgive the people who hurt you. And I said, have you ever had a Christian experience? She said, I don't know what that is. And I said, well, have you ever been saved? And she said, of course not. I said, only Baptists get saved. I'm a Methodist. And I said, well, Methodists need salvation too. And I said, let me tell you about it. So I told her about what God could do in her life, and she accepted Christ and was at least partially healed. Her anger over a period of time gradually subsided, and she eventually was able to function again normally. And it was shortly after that that a letter came across my desk from the curriculum committee of the medical center wanting new courses if we had any to offer. And the Holy Spirit, I guess, moved me and said, well, why don't you submit that, a program for Christianity and Medicine? I said, okay. So I wrote up a little prospect of the course and sent it in to the not expecting it to get approved, but, you know, when the Holy Spirit tells you to do something, you do it. And I got a letter back about 3 weeks later saying your course has been approved. It's interesting, I later asked the guy who was chairman of a committee why they approved it, and he said, weren't going to stand in God's way, which was interesting. This was a guy who I had the privilege later of leading to Christ, and he was dying of pulmonary fibrosis, and I went by to see him, and he immediately brought up the subject of his salvation, and we talked about it, and he accepted Christ, and I went back a month later, and he was reveling in the fact that he was now a Christian. And it wasn't long before a student came to me by the name of Jim Timmons. He went down to general practice in South Carolina. Jim came and said, can you teach me how to integrate my faith? And I said, well, Jim, I don't know, but we'll do it together. We'll learn together. And so we did a research project. I had some research stipends, and so he worked with me during the summer for his $800 stipend. And we did a research project on 10 alcoholics, 10 people with depression, and 10 people who were dying of cancer. And we were inquiring as to what God had done or was doing in their lives. It was interesting that of the 10 people dying of cancer, half of them were Christians, and they had no anxiety about their impending death. Or if they did, they had minimal anxiety. It was compared to the others who were quite anxious about it. We found out that at least half of the depressions, which we got off the wards at the VA and at Duke, were spiritual depressions. They really had to do with their spiritual life. And the people with the alcoholism, we had, you know, this bunch of drunks at the VA with 10 years of alcoholism or better. And the interesting thing was that when we asked them what the effects of alcoholism had been on their life, they all became very convicted of their wrongness of their alcoholism. And I said, what do we do? Eight out of ten. And I realized that God could use God's power and His wisdom to help people get well and to be healed. of the problems that they had. And it was after that that the word got out. Dave Larson came, and a bunch of other people came. We eventually had 108 medical students, 30 psych residents, and at least 25 or 30 missionaries and general practice and surgical residents who came through the program to learn how to integrate their faith. And that's how I got started, and that's a long start. It just gradually evolved.
My life changed, and I think that of many psychiatrists or residents who trained here. My life changed when, in 1978, a patient in the hospital where I was working showed me a copy of Guidepost magazine. And it said, Duke's pioneer in Christian psychiatry. And I thought, what? I had never seen those two words used together. And so I wrote you a letter and said, I don't know what you do or how you do it, but if you take students, I've got a month elective coming up. And so in 1978 or 1979, I came here and spent a month or 6 weeks with you. And that article has proved so pivotal to many of us. And I could just give you a list of the people. I'm sure I'd miss some, but Dave Larson, myself, Lee Bishop, Ted George, Mary McMahon, Mary Christenberry, Kim Sherrill, Mike Lyles, Scott Cunningham, Joe Roderson, Bob Bungie. There's just been
Randy Christensen and George Christensen.
Correct. Jeff Okamoto.
Yeah.
How did you go about trying to put together guidelines of what to teach us and how you should take these people who are absolutely green? I had never had any interest in psychiatrists, and I never wanted to be a psychiatrist, and decide how you would mature us in the process.
Well, I think the thing was that I realized that the Bible had information in it that was applicable to the treatment of illness. The main thing I had then to do was to learn how a person's spiritual life paralleled their biological life. Now, I had been through child psychiatry. I had 2 years of training in child psychiatry, and I learned a lot about human development and also the development of the psyche and personality development during that time. And so I began to look at the spiritual development of people, because it was beginning, I began to hear stuff in the church that said people were talking, where people were talking about spiritual development, but they weren't quite sure what it was. And eventually God showed me what it really was, and I was able to draw up an algorithm for it, and devise an algorithm that would teach us how to approach people. You approach people from three standpoints. That meant I had to learn about human nature. Dave Larson, one night, he was living with us at the time in his one of his rotations. I think it was a summer he spent with us doing research. And he said, tell me about human nature. Well, I never heard of human nature. They didn't teach you that in medical school. So we looked in the scriptures, and sure enough, there in Thessalonians, it says that we body, soul, and spirit. And I realized that if we're going to do holistic medicine, we have to treat all of those. Well, I knew how to treat the body pretty well. I was a good doctor. But I didn't know anything about the development spiritually of people. And then I realized that spiritual development always begins when people are born again and when they accept Christ as their Lord and Master. You can't be developed spiritually unless you have the Spirit. And so I had, first of all, to get a good view of human nature, and then try to figure out how, when spiritual development begins, how it progresses and what factors enter into that.
How it develops.
Yeah. And so I had to learn what discipleship truly was. And one of the things that bothered me was I couldn't find anything that appealed to me as a discipleship. I'd read a lot of stuff on it. But I did realize that people had to learn how to be a Christian. You just like you learn to talk, and you learn to walk and talk and manipulate various objects and do things in your life. You also have to learn how to pray and how to study the Bible and how to do things like that. Well, I was on the Curriculum Resources Committee of the United Methodist Church at the time, and that really stimulated me, because I found out that they really didn't have anything that was good for discipleship. And so my whole goal was to disciple medical students. And I realized that I had been, in essence, discipled, not really discipled in psychiatry. I was discipled in the classical sense, because the meaning of the word is to teach.
Hmm.
And I had this wonderful teacher as a mentor. He was a Jew, but he knew more about Christianity than 99% of the people I know who are Christians outside of people who've been to divinity school.
That was Dr. Holman?
Yes, Leslie Holman. He was a graduate of Hopkins and had trained there in psychiatry under Adolf Meyer. But he also was associated with John Watson, who was the originator of, well, mostly of behaviorism, and
yes,
along with Horsley Gant, who was also a behaviorist. He had studied under Ivan Pavlov, and so Dr. Holman really had a good background. On top of that, he was a neuropathologist and done some other things, and he really guided my career. And I realized that one of the things I had to do with the Christians who came to me wanting to learn how to integrate their faith was to mentor them and guide them in the development of their thing. Well, you can't be a mentor unless you love people. You love your students, and I always did. I just really loved every student I ever had, even though some of them were pretty nasty and unlovable. I nevertheless was able to do that, even when I was a pagan, because almost every chief resident came and worked with me in research during my pagan days, and a lot of medical students came and wanted me to teach them too. But it got much more florid. There were many more people came after I became a Christian, because there was a lot of Christians who couldn't find anybody else to do it, and so they came to me.
This is a real change in your career, from going from a more biologically based psychiatry. In fact, when I came here, you were the head of the Division of Biological Psychiatry and Encephalography, and did a lot of work with EEGs. And then in your book, The Grace to Grow, you described your conversion experience that happened to you when you were in Canada fishing.
No, I wasn't fishing. I was canoeing.
Canoeing.
I was teaching a bunch of Boy Scouts how to live in the wilderness.
You had this conversion experience, came back home, and decided you were going to change how you practice psychiatry.
I didn't really decide. God just made me do it. I mean, I just wanted to do it. There was this burning desire in me to learn how to use my faith in healing people, because I got involved in the lay witness movement and heard how so many people, prostitutes and drunks and drug addicts and people whose lives were empty and meaningless, how they had been dramatically transformed by a salvation experience and then growth in their Christian faith. And I knew that if it could do that without any psychiatric intervention, if I was a psychiatrist, I could devise ways of utilizing that to bring about change in people's lives.
Yes.
And that's how I got into it.
Developed this program for the study of Christianity and medicine, which was accepted by Duke University. Then the article came out in Guidepost, and then this wave, this flock of new residents who wanted to be trained.
Well, mostly students first, and then I conned them into going into psychiatry and Duke.
Well, that's how it happened with me. I came here as a student, and I had really very little interest in psychiatry. I'd had the prodding of one professor, but after spending a month here and spending a month with you, I realized not only I found what I wanted to do, but I knew I had to come here and learn from you, because you can't just get this out of a textbook.
There are no textbooks, unfortunately.
Correct. It's like a blacksmithing or anything else. You need to watch that person do their work day in and day out and spend time with them. And there's just no substitute for that.
Amen. I agree to that. I've always believed in monkey see, monkey do.
When you were younger, had you planned on going into psychiatry?
No. As a matter of fact, whenever I went to my reunion, class reunions, and they'd say, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm a psychiatrist." "You a psychiatrist? You're the last person on earth I think would be a psychiatrist." But what happened was that I was in Panama, and I got a bad sleep deprivation syndrome, which precipitated a mild depression in me. I finished my internship there, which was a wonderful experience in the third world. It was just great place to learn about medicine, but learn about the sociology of medicine as well. And I came back, and I did. The dean would not give us our diploma until we had 2 years of training, and I only had one, and I couldn't go into private practice. I tried to go into anesthesia, but they wouldn't take me because they didn't think I had enough medicine behind me. And so I only applied two places, and one of them I didn't want to go to, and the other one, Wisconsin, turned me down. I guess that was the Lord's business, because he had me all set up, and I got home, and Dr. Holman, who had been helping me with the depression that I had, said, "Why don't you go to work in a state hospital?" And I said, "That's ridiculous. I don't want to go over there in that snake pit." And he said, "Well, I think you really ought to do it." So I go to work in a state hospital, paid a royal sum of $2,000 a year, what was room, board, and laundry. I had a nice apartment, and I got all three meals a day, and they did all my laundry without pay. And you got to remember, this was in just after the war in 48. But I met my wife over there. I met Elizabeth, my wife. And Dr. Holman came over two mornings a week, and he'd spent 3 hours, two mornings a week, teaching me psychiatry. And it became so interesting and so exciting because he really cared about me and really loved me. I decided to go into psychiatry. Well, I hadn't decided it until about 3 or 4 months before I'd been there a year. I'd been there in about 9 months. And he came one day and said, "Hey, I just got a grant from the NIH to do child psychiatry." And he said, "You'll be eligible as a fellow. So would you like to come work with me next year?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." So I went over, and for $200 a month, I was a fellow in child psychiatry for 2 years. Well, in the meantime, he got me involved in research, and I began to do chemical and neurophysiological research. And I found that very interesting and very exciting. And then eventually, he steered me into going to Montreal and getting neuroscience training at the Neurological Institute up there. And that's how I got into psychiatry.
So Dr. Holman was really a mentor for you.
Absolutely. He was unequivocally a mentor.
He wrote a book called As the Twig is Bent.
Right.
About child development.
Well, it had to do with really how do you discipline children and to train them. But he also quoted, "Train up a child as he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it."
Solomon.
And so the book was really about how do you train children and how do you discipline them.
Well, when I came here, I was determined to do a residency and to hang around people like you and Dan Blazer. It was a great time to be at Duke. We found you to be an outstanding teacher. Keith Brody was the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and was a good leader. Keith Brody then became president of the American Psychiatric Association, so we were getting all kinds of good academic speakers through here. And a residency, which is usually not the sexiest in the hospital, like psychiatry, had become kind of a powerhouse. And there was such an esprit de corps among the group of us. And I don't know if you remember, but I remember some very basic guidelines that you gave us about how to conduct ourselves as young psychiatrists in training. And the first was that your competence is your first witness. And that your phrase was, you guys have to be better than the average bear. All of you do. So your first witness is just to do good work and keep your mouth shut until you understand the field. And don't even discuss spiritual things or try to pray with someone until you really gained a thorough understanding of them and know them well. And that has stuck with me through the years.
Well, that's what I've always done. One thing, in World War II, I was in the Army, and one of the things they taught you was not to stand up, because if you did, someone would shoot at you. And I said, well, that's what I got to do being a Christian in a pagan environment, because I knew that there was a lot of hostility to Christianity, because one of my professors one day took a patient's Bible and threw it down the hall, said, "Get that damn thing out of here." Hmm. And that just, I thought after I became a Christian, good gracious, if they're going to do that to a Bible, what are they going to do to me? And so I decided to keep a low profile. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't do anything. I wasn't flagrant. I would not pray with my patients when a resident or a medical student was there, unless I knew that that medical student or resident was a Christian. It turned out that was a wise thing to do, because a number of my faculty people, colleagues, commented to me, said, we know you're a Christian, but you're not pushy about it or something to that effect.
Hmm.
said, you know, that's a good witness for you. And so that was the reason I adopted that. But I knew that there would be objections. For instance, Dave Larson, after we'd been talking about demon possession, and had a patient who thought she had 40 demons, and he tried to cast them out. I had told him not to do that, but he did.
Dave did?
Yeah, and boy, they really sat on him about it, and I had to do all kinds of flip-flops to get him out of trouble. But we succeeded because most people respected me and respected my opinions. And so I thought it was interesting that you know, most of you did exactly what I asked you to do. And I think that's true. I mean, I know we had one faculty member who was a real, oh dear, he was awful. And the guys had to rotate through his service, and they'd come and say, I just can't stand it. I don't want to be on that service. I said, look, go and learn what not to do in psychiatry. And yeah. they would do that. They would learn what was wrong and what people shouldn't do.
Another guideline and kind of a model that has stuck with me through the years is, you said, well, I just take the pie and divide it into four parts: biological, psychological, social, and spiritual. And a psychiatrist needs to be a good enough diagnostician to know which part needs the intervention and to make the appropriate intervention in that sphere.
Well, that was another thing we had to do. We had to delineate what were spiritual interventions. And there are about eight of them, which is interesting because if you go to the Bible, some of them overlap with secular interventions, but nevertheless, the Bible probably spoke to it first, so that they're not really secular. They're just adopted from the spiritual realm. If you look at Christian spiritual development, it begins, as we said, with salvation, but then they have to be discipled.
Yes.
And then they have to learn what's in the Bible and learn a new value system, because it was once said that God's commandments become your wants when you become a Christian. And I think that's true, that you want to be obedient. You want to do, because Jesus said, you know, if you love me, you will obey my commandments. So you got to be obedient. And people generally want to be. Then they want to associate with other people, so that they have to get involved in a church and in worship. There they can grow, hopefully. Some churches they can't grow in because they're dead as a doornail, but there's no fertilizer there to help them move on. But I think the real issue is that once people learn that, then there's the diseases are unregeneracy, to be unregenerate, not knowing the Lord as your Savior. Number two is sin, which can infect both Christians and non-Christians, but particularly non-Christians. And the third one is possession states, which is what Satan's work in the world does. And then there's finally, the last one is fanaticism.
As much work as you've done on spiritual conditions, I remember another guideline you gave to us is to really resist becoming what you call the spiritual reductionist, that all people's problems are just spiritual and you pray them away.
Well, the master of that is Jay Adams. He's a spiritual reductionist of the first order. Everything is sin, and everything, the only treatment is confession, repentance, and forgiveness, and that's it. And that's reductionism at its worst.
Mm, yes.
A lot of people fall for that, but there's a great tendency. Recently, there's a guy who devised a system called theophostic counseling, which is nothing more than cognitive behavioral treatment. And Bill Backus was the first person to write that up. He called them misbeliefs. This guy calls them lies. But everybody got real worked up over theophostic.
Yeah.
I thought, Lord, that's crazy. I've been using that ever since I became a Christian. Mm-hmm. I used it before I became a Christian, because Dr. Holman was a cognitive behavioral psychiatrist.
I thought when I first came here that people were coming to see you because you were a Christian. And I'm sure that had something to do with it. But the longer I spent here, the longer I worked with you, I realized they came to see you because you were good. And it wasn't just because you had some flag waving out front, Christian psychiatrist down the hall. It was because you knew what you were doing. And I think that was an excellent role model for all of us.
Well, Dr. Holman drilled that into me. He was a superb diagnostician and a great psychopathologist. So he really understood not only how to go about getting information out of patients, but how to use that information to treat them. He encouraged me to read the classics like Eugen Bleuler and Emil Kraepelin and some of the others. But I had this great thirst for knowledge, and so like this morning, for instance, I want to know whether Cape Horn was further south than Cape of Good Hope. And so I go and find out that there's 20 degrees difference in it, that Cape Horn is 20 degrees closer to Antarctica than is Cape of Good Hope.
I wondered why you were looking that up this morning.
Well, that was trivia, but it was something that that just intrigued me at the moment. And having an inquiring mind, I had to know what the answer was.
An interest in knowledge and the world.
Right. I think that's true, and it's a basic inherent thing in me, because from the very beginning I was like I taught myself to read when I was 4.5 years old. I started school when I was just before I was 5, because in those days you could start anytime if you had the ability, but I always was wanting to know what was in there and what's in that closet over there, and what is that tree and what's the name of that tree, and
a curiosity.
Yeah. It's an inquiring mind. That's why I got involved in research.
Years ago when I read that cover of Guidepost magazine and I saw those two words used together, Christian psychiatry, it mystified me. And now they're commonly thrown together. What do you think of the term Christian psychiatry, or referring to oneself as a Christian psychiatrist? What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, that was a big debate in the Christian Medical and Dental Association's psych section. I never had any problem with it, because I am a Christian and I am a psychiatrist. I am not a Christian and a psychiatrist. I am a Christian psychiatrist because I integrate my faith into what I do. And so I never had any problem with it, but a lot of people do have a problem with it.
So you're very comfortable with that term?
Yep, no sweat. No problem.
It seemed to have been a debate of a number of years ago, and I really don't hear much about it any longer.
Well, I think people have come to realize that God wants them to identify themselves as Christian psychiatrists. But I don't think a person should do that if they're a Christian and a psychiatrist. They go to church on Sunday and do everything on Sunday, and then the rest of the week they live like a pagan and practice like a pagan. I don't see any how you can call yourself a Christian psychiatrist if that's the case.
Or just two parallel lives, people that are believers and try to live that way, but it doesn't really impact their life, their professional life. I see it like a train track with two parallel tracks. When you were in practice at Duke, did you find your new self and your new worldview was met with resistance by your colleagues, or were they fairly accepting of who you were?
Well, they accepted me for what I was because of what you talked about was my psychiatric ability. I was just a good doctor.
Yes, good teacher.
Yeah, and I think some of them avoided having any intercourse with me. Fred Hine was one, and some of the psychoanalysts really avoided me like a plague. Most of the other guys who were eclectic psychiatrists were really very accepting of me and had no problem. As a matter of fact, they would refer patients to me who needed to be saved.
So some resistance, but not a lot, because you were already an established teacher here.
Yeah, well, I think God knew that. He didn't save me until I had tenure. And I was well known. I was considered at one time, and this is fact, not brag, I was one of the top 10 young psychiatrists in the country. Others went on to become chairman of departments and that kind of stuff, but I never really wanted to do that. I just wanted to take care of patients and teach and serve the Lord. I was offered several chairmanship, but I just turned them all down.
I think I can speak certainly for myself and for so many of the group that were here. We referred to ourselves as the serpents and doves, be as wise as serpent and harmless as a dove, that we understood firsthand what it was like to be mentored, to have someone spend a lot of time with you going over cases and in supervision. but not limited to that. Someone who really cared about us and loved us and cared about our development. And that has made me realize that mentors change the world. And every one of us have gone on to try to pass that on in some way in our career.
Well, I don't think there's any question you're right. When I looked at the Department of Medicine at Duke with Eugene A. Stead as the chairman, Gene was a great mentor. He happened to be a pagan and was hostile to the gospel. But he really loved his students, and he drove them mercilessly, but he also really cared about them and really wanted their careers to succeed. And I worked under him in my research career for 2 years, and he did exactly that with me. And so I had Dr. Holman and Gene Stead, two of the top mentors in the country, mm-hmm. and Herbert Jasper at Montreal, all of whom mentored me in ways that I'd never... Dr. Jasper wasn't a very loving person, but he was a great teacher. Mm. And that made a difference because I didn't need to be loved at that point. Just when I started, I needed to be loved. But it was, you know, when you get a chance to work under some of the best people in the world, and like you said, listen to some of the best people in the world. I mean, when I was in Montreal, Lord Adrian came, and Sir John Eccles, the great neurophysiologist, came. And there were all kinds of people who came there who had a profound influence on me, even though I just heard one or two or three lectures from them.
Wilder Penfield was there?
Wilder was. You know, I watched him operate, and while Dr. Jasper did the electrocorticograms, and it was really a great experience.
A few nights ago, I was at the home of Ted George, a dear friend and another Dukie who did the program here. And he and Angie and Claudia and I were talking about how that month rotation, that 6-week rotation, changed our lives, changed what we decided to do with our lives, and therefore changed where we lived, changed how we practiced, and I think we all just felt so blessed and so fortunate to be able to have a program in the late 70s and early 80s that was so enjoyable. There doesn't seem to be a center any longer where there's one gathering place. If I could shift to kind of an educational focus in for a while, how do you see this being passed on in terms of medical education at the present time? What can we do to leave a trail for those behind us?
Well, there's only one group I know of who's trying to do the same thing I did, and that's the Medical Evangelism Training Strategies Group, or Medical Strategic Network, that Yang Chen runs out in Phoenix. It sort of shifted south from Loma Linda because mm-hmm. nobody there to support it other than your friend, the
Harvey Elder.
Yeah, Harvey Elder. I mean, he's a wonderful Christian doctor. I love him dearly. But Paul Liu and Dave T.A. and Judy Hunt have got a thing going down in Phoenix. They don't have a medical school. They do have some affiliation with University of Arizona Medical School, but I'm not real sure that it's a truly academic environment. So, but at least they've got the right idea.
Yes.
They're doing what thing? They bring students in for the summer and have them work for a couple of months under the supervision of a physician who is a Christian, who integrates their faith. That's the only place I know of that really offers it. But they're doing a great job of helping students learn how to integrate their faith. But the problem is they don't have them for long enough, either a weekend. But now that they've instituted the summer program, they're much better off and much better at helping students gain what you guys gained under when I was running my program.
It seems to me that no matter where someone goes who's interested in psychiatry or perhaps even thinking of becoming a psychiatrist, they'll need that common denominator that was so important for you and so important for all of us. They'll need another human being who can act as a mentor.
Yeah, I think that you guys could, if you would, enter into I mean, I sat on the last board meeting of Medical Strategic Network, and one of the things I encouraged them to do was to find mentors.
Yes.
And then use
yes.
their central location to farm students out to people like you. I mean, I can imagine a lot of students would love to come spend a month with you in the summertime or in the winter.
Up in the mountains, yeah.
I mean, you're right there at Vail and Aspen, but I don't know whether they'll do that or not. I'm going to encourage them to do it.
Dr. Wilson, before we bring this interview to a close, I know that you feel that how we all live at home is really important. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I think all of us need balance in our lives. And there's a great tendency on the part of psychiatrists and physicians in general to neglect their family life and focus on just their practice.
Your career.
You know, I always made it a point that I would be home for supper and I would spend at least 2 hours with my kids. And we moved to a place close to the university, so I didn't have to take long to get back over there. It wasn't a bad commute. And so I would come home at 6 o'clock and we'd have dinner, and then I would bathe the kids and talk to them and hear their prayers and put them to bed. I always had time for my wife. We always spent some time every day communicating. And over a period of time, I realized that one of the great problems that we as Christian psychiatrists are going to have to deal with are relationships. And relationships are the basis of happiness. If you have a knowledge, if you know God personally, if you have a good marriage, if you have children who grow up to be healthy, children of worth, and if you have friends, and if you have a creative vocation. I mean, I loved what I did vocationally. I just loved to treat patients. I think every psychiatrist needs a good family life. If you remember that Paul, in his instructions to Timothy, said that church leaders should be people with one wife, that children should be obedient, and that they should have a good family life. And the Bible is very explicit about what constitutes a good family life, and I don't think there's any question that there has to be love and order in a family, and psychiatrists should have it. And that means that we have high levels of communication,
mm-hmm.
that there's love and order in the family, that appropriate discipline, that we're teaching our kids values, and we subscribe to appropriate value system, which is biblically based. And above all, that we are reaching out to other people who are not as fortunate. Well, of course, we do that in our career and medical activity, our treatment of patients. But it's important to always remember our family. I mean, you and I were talking about one of our colleagues who was working a 12 to 14 hour day.
Yes.
That's ridiculous. You don't have to do that. You don't need that much money.
Well, and one of your basic teachings is that the fundamental basis of happiness is our successful relationships.
That's right. I'd never thought about that. One of my theological colleagues asked me once. He said, "What constitutes happiness?" And I thought about it overnight. And I said, I prayed about it. And the Lord said, "You know, it's relationships." And if I look at my practice through the years, I'd say 90% of the patients I got came because of negative relationships that they had with various people in their
life.
I mean, it's either the work, where they got negative relationships with their boss or their fellow workers, or it's their marriage. Good Lord, I've seen marriage problems where relationships were just distorted beyond all concept. Or their kids are all messed up, or they don't have any friends. I was just interested, let's see the other day, that 90% of pastors in the pulpit have no friends at all. Can you imagine
that? That's sad.
Huh?
That's sad.
It is sad.
Dr. Wilson, as you look back over your career, what's had the most significance? What's been the most enjoyable for you?
The whole thing. I enjoyed doing research. I enjoyed learning new things after asking questions. I enjoyed taking care of patients. I enjoyed teaching medical students and nurses. I started out teaching nurses, and now I'm teaching preachers. You know, I can't say there wasn't anything I didn't enjoy about my career. Well, I take that back. Sitting on committees was a horrible show.
You didn't mind having that gone.
Well, you know, committees are a bunch of people sitting around trying to draw attention to themselves. That's basically what it amounts to. That's even true in the church, you know. If you sit on the governing body
That's
of the
true.
Church,
yeah,
it's just a waste of time. Most of those decisions could be made and be over with.
If I ever have to give accountability for the wasted time in my life, it won't be entertainment or fun. It will be church board meetings.
That's right.
Well, to say thank you, Dr. Wilson, seems redundant. I am just so appreciative of your courage and the desire then, not to have to, the desire to want to bring that back into your practice and have set up those rotations years ago that have paid dividends 25 years later. It's hard for me to believe that I'm back here walking the beautiful Duke campus with stone buildings and dogwood in bloom and now sitting in your home. And it's all been such a great ride. On behalf of all of us, I wanted to thank you for today and particularly thank you for your dedication to your career and to the Lord.
Well, the one thing is for sure, that it was all done in love.
It's our blessing. Thank you.